This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The fall sports seasons for high schools and colleges begin soon, and the practices for football, soccer, volleyball, and other sports have already begun. For athletes and others spending time outdoors, attention has to be paid to how the body is behaving during exercise in the heat. Last week, research conducted by the University of Arkansas and the University of Connecticut examined how some high school athletes at Bentonville and Rogers reacted to an experimental cooling device. Brendan McDermott is a professor of kinesiology at the University of Arkansas. Last week, he talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the research, as well as about the science studying the causes of heat stroke and related conditions.
Hydration is a main component that is present most often with heat exhaustion and exertional heat stroke, but it's not a necessity. You can have exertional heat stroke and not necessarily be dehydrated, but it's one of the things that we can end up doing, obviously, to prevent. And it's one of the things that is behaviorally, because there's some other innate things that may contribute to exertional heat stroke that maybe are out of our control. But so in terms of performance and feeling good when we're gardening or mowing the lawn and exerting ourselves perhaps minimally, it is more dehydration, perhaps heat exhaustion if it is in extreme heat that can affect us. Exertional heat stroke typically does come into play when it is at least moderate or long-term duration exertion. So right. Moderate to extreme exertion. You know, and a lot of times in athletics, it comes into play where we have somebody may actually feel symptoms or they may not feel symptoms of heat exhaustion. So things like dizziness, nausea, we may get lightheaded, just an overwhelming feeling of heat and that sort of thing. Yet at the same time, a coach may be annoyed at how the team's performing and blowing a whistle and saying, give me 10 push-ups, do some up-downs, give me some more sprints, and pushing people beyond what their normal limits are. That's when we're seeing it, or when somebody has a goal time in a distance race. Mm-hmm. So a half marathon or a marathon type distance, and somebody has a goal time and they're really pushing towards that, or the last 2 miles they step it up and I'm almost at my goal time, let me do this, and then they sprint it in and the next thing you know they collapse and they never really had any signs and symptoms of heat stroke per se. But they felt fatigued, obviously, because they were pushing it towards the end. But they had that goal in mind, and they're pushing for it.
I would think that in that situation, and perhaps in a sports practice as well, it's hard for the athlete to sometimes realize, because of course I'm fatigued. I'm at the end of I'm 24 miles into a run,
yes.
Or I'm an hour and a half into this practice.
Yes.
So I should be feeling fatigued. So knowing the difference between what would be a normal fatigue and what is potentially dangerous.
And it does become a little different, too. And it's difficult to determine, is it dangerous or is it not, because there's a lot of things. It's a multitude of things that can lead to exertional heat stroke. So one of which is pushing through some of those signs and symptoms. But, you know, normal fatigue, you would expect athletes to kind of know this is normal fatigue versus not so normal fatigue. They probably should tell somebody. We also like to promote in sports medicine and athletic training that there's kind of a buddy system where if you're in your group and you're a lineman or you're a wide receiver and you're in a huddle with your people or at a practice doing drills with your people and with your buddy, if they're not acting right, tell somebody and then they can watch you.
Because you're not always the best judge of your own.
Absolutely. So a lot of times in athletics, what leads to success is pushing through some of those things, especially in distance events or intense practices and intense activity. Sometimes that's why we do it. Sometimes it's one of those, it's a motivating thing.
So how do you know if you're not, quote, the professional or truly experienced athlete that this is normal fatigue?
You don't. And that's what makes it difficult. So, yeah. You could err on the side of caution. Or one of the things that I always like to tell people, too, is if there is an organized event like that, that is a distance event where those types of things are a potential, is pay attention and ask questions. For example, what is the medical scenario that exists in this marathon? Mm-hmm. You know, so if I do succumb to one of these and I do collapse or somebody collapses at mile 25, Who's going to take care of me? Is there an emergency action plan? Are there AEDs around? get the bigger things out of the way, to just ask a question, what's the medical coverage? And, you know, if it seems appropriate, that's something to pay attention to. There are people specifically trained to recognize and treat these things. You know, hydration for the average individual out there is pretty easy to pay attention to. So if you're thirsty, pretty much you're 2% dehydrated or more. Mm. And you can think about it in terms of urine color is something that's been recommended. Some people recently have touted it not being the most accurate because there's supplements and there's different things in our diet that may change color. But if we're consistent with those things, like a multivitamin may change color a little bit. But if it's, you know, darker one day than it is another day, dark means that you're more dehydrated.
And there are a lot of people who want to run a marathon and not have to stop.
Of course.
You know, so they try to – is that wise to try to not have to urinate during 26.2 miles?
It's a hindrance for your time, perhaps.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend we purposely dehydrate to run a marathon to not have to pee. But the other way I always tell people, and we'd recommend that experts have been recommending for a few years now, is sweat rate is different for everybody. And that really determines how much we should be consuming. Because the major concern now in a lot of the distance races has been, especially the extreme distance races where it may take us 24 hours, the potential does exist for us to overhydrate during some of those and treat dehydration as the main thing that is going to be a hindrance for us. So we overconsume fluids. In fact, I know of a case in a half marathon of a woman that gained 12 pounds.
She gained 12 pounds while running a half
running
marathon?
Running 13 miles, yes.
Oh,
and
gosh.
She ended up having, you know, exertional hyponatremia and dying. So
It's
potentially fatal the opposite way. So balance is a big thing. And sweat rate varies largely. So there are very small people that are, you know, 150 pounds that may sweat 3 or 4 liters an hour participating. And there's other people that same size, shape, everything – that sweat maybe 1 liter an hour. So in essence, your rehydration goals are going to be starkly different between those two individuals. So the biggest thing, recommendation that I have for everybody is you pay attention to urine color, you pay attention to thirst, and you also know your own sweat rate in terms of athletic activity or exercise outdoors. And to measure your sweat rate is very simple. If you're going outside to do a workout, you take your body weight beforehand with as little clothing on as feasible, you go exercise and you weigh yourself again afterwards. And if you consume fluid during activity, you would just add that.
How much fluid?
Back into your post weight. So it's pre-weight minus post weight. And then if you work out for an hour, that would be your sweat rate. That's how much you lose per hour in sweat.
That's interesting.
And if it's a half hour, double it. That's how much you lose per hour. So if you're going to run a marathon, you should measure your sweat rate in similar conditions at a similar intensity that you're going to run your marathon, and you should have a general idea about, okay, during my trials of doing sweat rate, measure it a few times, make sure it's slightly accurate.
Right.
Because one time may not be the most accurate. But if you do that a couple times, you educate yourself on your own sweat rate, and you can basically plan it out where, okay, in the marathon now, I know I should be consuming this much.
Well, let's talk about some of the research that was happening here, because this is preseason for high school football. You went to some high school, I believe, in Rogers and Bentonville practices this week. What was happening there?
Well, for them, it was preseason football.
Right.
For us, it was an important field study. We were collecting a number of variables on our athletes or our participants that were helping us out with research. So we had a lot of technology with us, but the true ultimate goal of the study was to determine a hand cooling device, its effectiveness in preventing a rise in core temperature during what we were presuming would be exercise in the heat.
Right.
It wasn't as hot as we had expected, but either case, the athletes are stressed because it's preseason, so they may not be completely heat acclimatized at this point in time. This is the first week in Arkansas that they can participate with full pads and do full contact at practice. So the biggest thing that we were testing, the main outcome variable for us, is the rise in core temperature during practice. So somebody starts out at normal body temperature of, you know, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And then we looked to see if there are differences with matched controls. So what we did is we matched people based on body size and position and supposed exercise as well. So if you're a first ring person, most likely at practice you're going to get the same amount of reps. So what we did is we kind of matched people up accordingly and had one person get cooled every break from Tuesday through Friday's practice. And then his match got the control condition, which was no cooling, but still got monitored.
This glove, it just fits on your hand?
It actually slides on your hand, and it has the same material. It has to create a tight seal on your forearm because the technology that's within it is a vacuum, and there is also a bladder inside that fills up with cold water and continuously circulates cold water. So in essence, what it's doing is the vacuum allows maximum blood flow to the palm, mm-hmm. which is a good place to extract heat from the body. So your palm and your feet. We didn't have people take off their shoes and do the foot at the same time, and the glove is specifically for your hands. But in essence, what the goal is to vacuum, you know, make a tight seal, vacuum the blood flow right to the periphery, and then circulate the cold water so that as blood is flowing through the palm, you're extracting heat from the body. We were only doing this during break times, so we weren't controlling practice. We didn't tell the coaches you need to take a 10-minute break every 30 minutes. We did observational study. So they took we were measuring core temperature with an ingestible thermistor, so it really is a pill that people take.
Right.
And it transmits a radio signal based on their core body temperature.
It's amazing what technology allows you to study now.
It is very neat when you're looking at these things. Absolutely. It's cool.
And so the pill is swallowed and then it passes through the body after a time. But you can use that to get that core temperature and
yes.
read it.
So it transmits a radio signal. So during practice, we're walking up to our research subjects, those that took the pill, and just near their abdomen, you know, front or back, it transmits about 3 to 5 feet. And you just plug in a number that corresponds to their participant number and there's their core temperature, so we write it down.
And this is research, and you never know, and there are variables, and I don't want you to be – I'm not going to put you in the position to say, well, this means this or this means that. I understand how research works. But in a good world, this research will lead to
– it would lead to preventing heat illness and heat strokes, honestly. And at the same time, it may actually lead to better improved performance because most athletes that – feel better will also perform better.
But this is also something that could be used for the guy who's flagging traffic when you're paving or
yes.
someone who is in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the main thing that we're looking at is safety for people. And anybody that's exposed to the heat, whether it be in industry or construction or military, then has a chance to take a break. This research would apply to because they're doing strenuous activity in the heat and then they're taking a break and then doing strenuous activity in the heat repeatedly throughout their day, whether it's for work or military or what have you or athletics.
Could we call this cutting edge technology what you were working with this week?
Well, it is cutting edge technology.
Okay.
I mean, I look at it as there's a multitude of things out there that people have done to help prevent heat illness. Some of which have been shown to work, others of which have been shown to not really be that effective. So this is one of the things that in laboratory settings has shown some pretty good benefit with both core temperature and performance. So that is what draws people into its, you know, use. This is the first field study, to my knowledge, where it's been brought out of laboratory to see what happens in observational conditions when we're not controlling this. But we had enough data to look at what exercise people were doing to see if we found a true match for these individuals. And again, I mean, the hope is we're making it safer for a lot of people, anybody who's exposed to heat.
A couple weeks ago, I met some high school students who were part of an engineering camp at the University of Arkansas working on a solar boat project. Turns out it was a cloudy day and they couldn't really get the things going. And their mentors that day said, this is what sometimes happens with research, that conditions aren't what you think they will be. On paper.
Yes.
First week of organized football practice with pads in Arkansas in August. This should be, you know, boy, here's the study for heat because it's going to be the last 2 Augusts we've been in triple digits. You have one of the coolest Augusts on record.
Yes.
Does that make a difference?
You know, it's interesting, and we as a research team are not delighted to see the temperatures. Last week, I know there's people flying in from Connecticut and Florida to assist in the research, and you know, I texted them at one point and was like, did you look at the weather? And they're like, why? And I said, look at it. And they came back with, is this Fayetteville, Arkansas, really? I think we looked at the 10-year average, too, and it's almost 20 degrees cooler than normal. In this case, what we look at, though, is that football players exercising in heat, the uniform is really preventive for alleviating or dissipating heat for us. So essentially, the uniform creates a microenvironment inside it, and our bodies lose heat most effectively through sweat evaporation. So if the body is covered with what won't allow evaporative cooling, essentially it's not cooling anyways. So it may start out at a little bit cooler temperature, but the rate of rise really is determined by how much work they're doing, because their evaporative sweat loss is not really there. So there's only about a third of their body that's available for evaporative sweat loss. So in conditions like this, it does reduce the risk of a rise in temperature. And we may see temperatures in our research subjects that were not as high as what they would have been. But all in all, we still saw some decently high temperatures in our athletes. So I mean, the comparison is still there, and the athletes were all their counterpart or their matched control was still participating in the same conditions.
Brendan McDermott is a professor of kinesiology at the University of Arkansas. Last week, researchers at the U of A and the University of Connecticut studied a cooling apparatus with the cooperation of high school athletes in Bentonville and Rogers. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week.